As once I kind of found out Brother Dennis was recovering from back surgery and Brother James is traveling, and whenever they mentioned that this Sunday needed to be covered, I had a series of lessons. And this is something that I'd given a couple different times at some of the different congregations, different iterations of this lesson. And it kind of spurred from a conversation I had when I was in medical school. And it just so happened that these lessons are over topics that the Christian world this week have spent a lot of time thinking about. And that's the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The story kind of goes, as you get into medical school, first couple years you spend a lot of time looking into books. You're learning theories, you're learning physiology related to the human anatomy. You don't really have a whole lot of human-to-human interaction. And then your third year, that's all you have. And you get hit right between the eyes with all the different human interaction. And I was doing my ICU rotation, which is intensive care, and there was a patient that was going through respiratory failure. Basically, was on a vent, really struggling to breathe. And I made a comment, and I said, because I could tell that it wasn't going well, I said, this is kind of a rough way to go, because this patient was really struggling to breathe. And one of my classmates looked at me and said, well, that's how Christ died. And from that moment on, I started viewing the crucifixion of Jesus Christ with a medical point of view. And so that's kind of what I'm going to go through today, is we're going to get into the nuts and bolts, and some of this y'all might not enjoy, and I'm probably going to nerd out in some things, but I hope it's beneficial for you to better understand what Christ went through for us and what we've sung about, what we've memorialized with the Lord's Supper, with what we've prayed about. We're going to spend some time talking about this. As I was preparing for this, I was doing some yard work yesterday, and I just kind of went through the gospel accounts, and I listened to them. And I listened to all four of these accounts about three times. So in about 2 hours, you could listen to all four of these accounts three times. And so even if you don't do it three times, I challenge you in the next few days to try and go through this, because there's different points about each one of these that makes you understand more fully what Christ went through during this time. But I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time in the Gospels today. I actually want to spend a little bit more time on the historical account and some of the other things, just so that we can fully understand what the Gospels are telling us, because a lot of this stuff you all know very well. And, you know, Blake even quoted it, but in Mark it said, "And they crucified him." And they left it at that. And sometimes as Christians we just say crucified, and then we move on and we start talking about what it means and why it was necessary and how it allows us to have remission of sins and, you know, how baptism brings us into Christ's death and all these various aspects. We make it very intellectual. We make it very, theological. But I want to actually get into what crucified him meant. Crucifixion was a method of capital punishment. So you were punished by death for something that you had done wrong. And this was done by the Romans a lot of time. And there's some debate, if you get into the weeds a little bit, there is debate whether he was completely nailed or if he was tied to the cross, and there was probably multiple ways that they did it. And basically they were left hung there until eventual death from either exhaustion or asphyxiation, which means you can't breathe. Uh-oh. All right, so there it goes. Okay, it's coming slow. All right, so Cicero, this is a Roman historian, and as you can see on the screen, this was in the time before Jesus Christ, but pretty close in the same era. He was a Roman historian, sounds like he was a political speaker. He described crucifixion as this: cruel and disgusting, not to be mentioned in polite society. Roman citizens were often spared this form of capital punishment, and he stated that the crucifixion is the most terrible thing, was unworthy of a Roman citizen. Often they were scourged prior to the crucifixion. This was part of the crucifixion. This was to, and it talks about this in John 19:1, Matthew 27:26. Scourgings were performed basically to wear them out so that the crucifixion didn't last days. Because a strong, healthy 20, 30-year-old, maybe not like Brady, maybe more like Jordan, could last days. So they're going to take a little bit of that life out of them before they put them up on that cross. And there's even moments where they didn't survive the scourging or the flogging. Cicero, once again, in a speech against Varus, and this was around 43 BC, I believe, "It is a crime to bind a Roman citizen to scourge him. Is a wickedness. What shall I say about crucifying him? So guilty an action cannot be adequately expressed by any name bad enough for it." So we don't see crucifixions today. But the people of that world saw it. And they saw it a lot. And they didn't like to speak about it because it was so terrible. He says there's not even a name for it. So you can tell I don't do PowerPoint a lot, but if you can read this, our word excruciating comes from the Latin word excruciatus. Excruciatus means out of the cross. John 19:1, Pilate then took Jesus and scourged him. That's all it says. And then what does he say? What does that mean? So here's a picture, and I got this from the Archaeology of Biblical Society, and a lot of the documents and the things that I had got a lot of my resources from. This is what they kind of talked about. And a scourging or a flogging, and in the Latin it's called flagration, is another term that you might read or hear about. Basically, it's where they would take a post, and you can see there on that post, they would strap them to this post so that they couldn't fall down from exhaustion and other things. They would take that whip, which was called a flagrum, which was a short whip made of leather, often had steel balls attached to the ends, small sheep bones or other bits of hard material on the end. The sole purpose of that was to rip flesh. And this is something I don't think I realized as I was researching this, is that often there were two soldiers that would whip them. As you can see in the middle of that picture, we're looking from overhead. And you see a soldier on the bottom and then a soldier on the top. So if one guy got tired, the other one would help keep up the slack. And often they would alternate. And they would hit from the side, so perpendicular to them. And as they would hit, they would rake the metal and the bones across the back. Often to the point of bones showing through, intestines showing through, blood. Often they were naked. It was to humiliate these people. This was not a form of punishment that you did just because somebody did something wrong. You did it to send a message. You did it to make sure nobody else would do what they were accused of doing. It was a way to oppress people. It was a way for Roman to keep control, to keep order. And I imagine if you saw one of these, you wouldn't do what that guy did. Often it wasn't even reserved for women. It was only men. Specifically the scourging part, not always the crucifixion part. And Romans had no limit to the number of lashes that you would get. Now, in Jewish law, they did have a limit. It's uncertain, from what I understand, how many lashes Christ got. People have made speculations about that. You know, he was tried by a Roman, so there technically probably wasn't a limit. But sometimes with Jewish customs, the Roman would enforce the Jewish one. But one thing we know that's inferred by the gospel accounts is that it was pretty severe. Christ was unable to carry the beam. And whenever Josephus went to Pilate to ask for Christ's body, if you note in some of the gospel accounts, Pilate goes, "Oh, he's dead already?" He was surprised that it took that short amount of time for Christ to pass. And we suspect, based off 3 to 6 hours, is how long Christ was on the cross. So that kind of proves to you the idea of how extent this is. And like I just said, they, you know, after this, Christ, and also the other thing that was pretty common, once again, this was a spectacle. This was a process that was spent to try and deliver a message. The Romans were very, oftentimes they would mock and ridicule. You know, they dressed him up in a robe, they put the crown of thorns on him, they struck him, they spit on him, they mocked him. That was also part of the process. And often, if you read in the gospel account that Pilate wrote on there, on the plaque, that was a common thing. The thing that I've gathered from my research and stuff is that the gospel account is actually very normal. What they did to Christ was just another crucifixion that they had done for 500 years. This is something that the Romans had implemented for 500 years. They would often have them carry the cross, the crossbeam. And this probably wasn't the cross that you see people walking up and down the street sometimes with. It was probably just a beam. Most people suggest it was probably weighed 75 to 125 pounds. So that's about like having Thatcher on your shoulders. After you have had a whipping that had gotten down to the bone and tissues, you had to carry your own device of execution. Luke 23:33, when they came to the place called the skull, there they crucified him, and the criminals, one on the right and one on the left. So what does it mean, crucified? So, as you can see there on the left, the nails that they used were probably 5 to 7 inches. They were made out of iron. And the point of the nails was not to kill the person. The point of the nails was to hold them on the cross. And the Romans had specialized the best locations to do that. As you can see here on the wrist or on the hands. So when I first got into medical school, I was like, I don't think that the metacarpal, you know, so I'd always thought it was in the palm, right? And that's just because I'd never looked into it. And they've actually done studies on this. The nail in the palm would not have supported the weight of somebody on the cross. And so the more accurate location probably was one of two places. And most people suggest that it's probably in between your carpal bones and your radius, which is there's two big bones in your wrist. And so the big bone on the right and the big bone on the left. So in between there is a little soft spot. And if you look on your wrist, you can kind of feel that oftentimes. It's about right there. There's a little indention there. More than likely, that's where the nail would have gone. And the other possible location would have been down in this part of the wrist, so a little farther down. There's a real strong piece of connective tissue there that they probably would have gotten right up against that would have easily held under the weight of a human being. And you'll also note that they were smart because they didn't want somebody to bleed out. They wanted them to suffer. They wanted it to be a spectacle. There's an artery here called your radial artery and your ulnar artery. And they kind of come up and make a big loop. And so that's the perfect location to not hit those. And because if they would have hit that, they probably would have bled out in minutes. But one thing that is there that I'd never really thought about is your median nerve. So, have anybody ever hit their funny bone? Hurts. If you hit it real hard, it hurts really bad. Right? So that's a nerve. That's called your ulnar nerve. The nerve in your wrist is called your median nerve. There's a high likelihood that when they struck that, they would have severed the nerve. So think about the pain that you have when you hit your funny bone and then cut the nerve. So that's just bruising it. When you hit your funny bone, you're just bruising a nerve. When you cut it, that's serious. So in physician world, we quantify pain. Like people have done these different studies to try and figure out what is more painful than other things. So for you ladies, childbirth's way up there. Kidney stone, way up there. But consistently, the most painful thing is when you cut something off. And that's because of the nerve that you're cutting. You're severing a nerve, and that's one of the most painful things that patients have ever described that they've researched and done objective data about. So when they nail that nail through his wrist, and they sever that median nerve, that's one of the more painful things that somebody can live through. And once again, the whole idea is so that they can support themselves. And there's also a high likelihood that the hand is no longer functional. So when you sever your nerve, they get this little claw hand. So there's a decent chance that if they were crucified, there's a chance that they didn't sever the nerve on Christ. We'll never know. This is all just general conjecture and things that could happen, and as a physician, makes complete sense. I've given injections into the carpal tunnel before, which is exactly this cross section that you see. I've had patients call me 5 days later complaining of pain. I use an anesthetic that takes the pain away from the shot. I use a needle the size of a finishing nail, and they still complain for 4 or 5 days. Sometimes, not always. And usually the shot will start to work at that point, and then they're happy that we did it. But I cannot imagine taking something the size of this and jamming it through your wrist. The type of pain that you would have. Significant. So let's talk about the foot. This is something that was discovered back in the 80s, I believe, 85, 86, something like that. As you can see on the right is what is found to be a nail that was hit into the foot of some man that was crucified. And it's around the same time that Christ lived, 7 to 66 AD. So that would have fallen right around the time that Romans were probably doing the same type of crucifixions in the same area. This was found in Jerusalem. And notice where it's at. So there's notice there's a little space between the nail head and the bone. Oftentimes, and this is something I didn't realize, but oftentimes they would put a piece of wood to keep them from pulling out the foot from the nail. It would act as a washer, so to speak. And so they did analysis on this and they found wood here and here. So there was wood on both sides of the nail. And there's a high likelihood that on the hands that was true as well. So there would have been a wood plaque that was in between the nail and the flesh that would have acted as something to keep the victim from pulling his skin or his body off the nail. Once again, the purpose was to keep him on the cross. The sole purpose. It wasn't to kill him. So this is a kid's foot, so it's not exactly because they've got a growth plate here, but this is probably the spot right here, that little soft spot on the side that they would have gone through the side of the foot. This is called your calcaneus or your heel bone, and that's kind of the root word that was used in the Greek when they describe Christ, the heel, or when they're describing the crucifixion, they're usually talking about that. This is the talus, which is the main bone that supports your foot. So the whole idea of this was to be able to put weight. And, you know, growing up, I always thought that they put it somewhere down here. Also, been studied, probably not possible to hold the weight of somebody. And even sometimes there was a little seat. Sometimes there would be like a little seat for the person to sit on in addition to the nails that were holding them up. Sometimes there was something underneath the foot to hold them, such as a little pedestal for them to stand on in addition to that. And it was probably more on the sides of the cross. And this is conjecture. And all of this is based off of archaeological evidence, people that have researched Rome and the way that they crucified people. I don't know how Christ was crucified in particular. I'm just pointing out physical evidence that suggests how they would have done it around the time of Christ. So if you've seen a picture and you're like, nope, I think that's how they did it, then there's a possibility that they did it that way. But this is how most people suggest was probably his feet were nailed to the cross. And oftentimes there would be a bend in the knee, which we'll get to a little bit later on the importance of that. So we talked about the... One other thing I'll say... Whoa. See, I told you, it would be better next week when the professionals start, so I promise. The other thing I'll say, and there's some debate about whether or not they were tied or nailed. You know, Thomas talks about he wanted to see the nail scars in the hand, or nail scars. I don't remember if he said in the hand or not. So if you base it off the gospel account, there are some people that suggest that because of wood scarcity, they would not have wanted to disrupt the cross beam with repetitive nails, and so they would have probably tied the cross beam and then done the nail of the feet. The whole idea of the nails is not to kill the person, it's to hold them up there. So I don't think that that's really relevant in the grand scheme of things. Just, like I said, nerds that like to go through and debate things. So, me being one of those. A plaque across the top. So this is something that Josephus and other historians at that time, that was a common thing too. It's not like Christ was special by them putting King of the Jews. That was a typical thing. It was also to let people know what they did so that they wouldn't do whatever got them up on that cross. That was the whole point of the plaque. Often the little possessions was part of the payment to the Romans. The centurion and his men that were specially trained to do this execution, they were often, that was their job. Part of their payment was they got whatever the victim had. And we've read about in John 19 about them casting lots, which fulfills prophecies and various things. And they would also use various methods to cut short the time it would take to carry out the crucifixion. This is well documented by, there's a Quintilius who talked about that process and how they would break legs and all these things. So all the things that you read about in the gospel account is backed up by other secular history that suggests this was common practice during Rome. So when the gospel writer says they crucified him, everybody would have known exactly what that meant. So what actually kills the person on the cross? Once again, a lot of the doctors get kind of nerdy about this, about, well, what was it first? In general, I would say two things happen to most people when they pass away. Respiratory failure, cardiac arrest. Pretty safe in betting one of those two things is what leads to someone passing away. Now, the shock from blood loss, that's that whole part of the scourging, wearing them out before they get them up there, which is part of it. The asphyxiation, which is basically not being able to breathe. Cardiac arrest, talking about the basically your heart quits beating for various reasons. And there's some people that conjecture that when Christ hollered out and then breathed his last, he had some massive cardiac event at that moment, which would make sense to me medically. Sometimes acidosis, this is basically your tissues degrade to the point that the chemistry inside your blood no longer is working properly. This is probably for those prolonged crucifixions. Those ones that last days would be more common. Or if they were very malnourished in prison, various things like that. Hypoxia is lack of oxygen from not being able to breathe. So, here's a depiction of a man on a cross. When you take a breath, if you ever notice, what are you doing? You're actually contracting muscles that open your chest cavity. That creates a negative pressure that then pulls air from the outside inside, which then allows oxygen to change with your blood, to exchange with your blood. Then your heart pumps it to where it needs to go, and then it just this continuous cycle. So basically what happens when they put you on the cross is that you wear out. You're no longer physically able to move your body to take a breath, is the best way I can describe it. Stefan's here today. When we would wrestle, me and Stefan would wrestle when we were younger, and we would hold one of them down, and we'd put our feet up over their feet, you know, to where they're like kind of bent backwards, and your knees are up by your ears, and you hold it. I would try and hold him down as long as I could, and he'd start freaking out because he'd say, "I can't breathe." Why is that? His muscles could not take a big deep breath. You see these guys on a dog pile and you're the guy at the bottom of the dog pile. And they're like, get off, I can't breathe. It's because they're not strong enough to move the pile enough to get a deep breath. In essence, that's what happens on the cross. You're not physically able to take a breath. The only way that you can take a breath, because if you're hanging like this, you can't get your chest open to breathe. So what you have to do is you have to use your arms and your feet to pull yourself up to let air in, and then you drop and rest. Most people, when they're comfortable, take 16 to 20 breaths per minute. So now, if somebody is hypoxic, in shock from a scourging, he's probably needing to breathe 30 to 40 to maybe, if they're young and healthy, maybe up to 45, 50, but then you're getting into scary territory. In order to get enough oxygen to your body. So you think about doing 35, 40 pull-ups in a minute. When I was in great shape, I could do 20 for about 30 seconds. And then I had to rest for, that was back when I was in college 20 years ago. Then I would have to rest for several minutes and maybe try it again. And I could maybe do 3 or 4 sets of that and then I was toast. Christ was on the cross for 3 to 6 hours, most people suggest. And every time he pulled up, you felt the nail in his hand, the searing pain from the median nerve potentially being severed. That same feeling that you have when you can't catch a breath, you go underwater and you can't breathe, that is his normal. Unable to do it. One thing, and so then at the end, according to Josephus in his work, The Jew Antiquities, the Jews specifically buried the crucified before sunset. So one of the ways to expedite that was you break their legs, and then it's only upper body. And then at that point, it's going to be pretty quick. And there in John 19, 31 and 37, it talks about how they broke their legs, and then when they realized, they started to break the legs of the criminals on each side of him. And then when they broke the legs of them, and the soldier came and saw that he had probably already passed away, there are some people that conjecture that the soldier had mercy on him, and the piercing of it was the final blow. I could see both sides of the story, to be honest. And when they happened, they struck probably the right atrium, would have been the area that you would have aimed for, and they would have bled out immediately. And that was actually the final part of all crucifixions. The Roman centurion's job was to make sure that the victim was dead. So when people start trying to conceptualize, Christ wasn't dead whenever he came off the cross. He had fainted and then rose, which you'll hear people claim. These men that have been trained to do this, the Romans had perfected this act for 500 years. They probably knew when somebody was dead. And that piercing stab wound at the end would have finished him off one way or the other. This is something that I found that I thought was pretty good. Someone nailed to a crucifix with their arms stretched out on either side could expect to live no more than 24 hours. 7-inch nails would be driven through the wrist so that the bones there could support the body's weight. The nail would sever the median nerve, which not only caused immense pain, but would have paralyzed the victim's hands. The feet were nailed to the upright part of the crucifix so that the knees were bent at around 45 degrees. To speed death, executioners would often break the legs of their victims to give no chance of using their thigh muscles as support. It was probably unnecessary as their strength would not have lasted more than a few minutes, even if they were unharmed. Once the legs gave out, the weight would be transferred to the arms, gradually dragging the shoulders from their sockets. The elbows and the wrists would follow a few minutes later. By now, the arms would be 6 or 7 inches longer. The victim would have no choice but to bear his weight on his chest. He would immediately have trouble breathing as the weight caused the rib cage to lift up and force him into an almost perpetual state of inhalation. Suffocation would usually follow, but the relief of death could also arrive in other ways. The resultant lack of oxygen in the blood would cause damage to tissues and blood vessels, allowing fluid to diffuse out of the blood into tissues. including the lungs and the sac around the heart. This would make the lungs stiffer and make breathing even more difficult, and the pressure around the heart would impair its pumping. There's a patient that I remember quite vividly that passed away whenever I was in Tennessee from respiratory failure. The look on his face when he couldn't get his breath, I can see it today. And the thought of Christ, same look on his face. It's not an easy way to die. And what did he say? When they came to the place called the skull, there they crucified him. But Jesus said, "Father, forgive them." What a Savior we have. 1 Peter chapter 2. Then the lesson will be yours. I went a little long. I apologize for all the moms that have Easter dinner waiting. 1 Peter chapter 2. For this finds favor. If for the sake of conscience toward God, a person bears up under sorrows and when suffering unjustly, for what credit is there if when you sin and the harshly treated you endure it with patience? But if when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure, this finds favor with God. Verse 21. So why did Christ have to die such a gruesome death? Why couldn't the Romans just have cut his head off? Why couldn't they have just stoned him? For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in him, in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he himself bore our sins in his body and on the cross, so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed, for you were continually straying like a sheep, but now you have returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. We have a great Savior who did something remarkable for us because of our sin and our opportunity to be with Him solely relies on whether you choose to follow Him. Romans, it talks about being baptized with Him and then being raised anew. So that because of what Christ did, we can have that same. That's what His blood does for us. So if you're not a part of His body, if you've not been somebody that has chosen to follow Him, now is the time. Baptism is the avenue. For those that are already members of the church but have fallen away, also now is the time to turn yourself back to Him. If you have that need, I ask you to come as we stand and as we sing.